From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, broadcasting today in Boston.
And I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles. This is Here and Now. As soon as tomorrow, nearly 100 million Americans will be able to get a Moderna or Johnson & Johnson booster shot. The head of the CDC, Rochelle Walensky, says all three vaccines, including Pfizer, are safe and effective options. But Surgeon General Vivek Murthy wants to stress that this doesn't mean we all need to rush out to get a booster. Here he is on Morning Edition.
This is an option now that people have. We don't want people to feel that they need to rush out today and get the shot immediately at their six-month mark if they got Pfizer or Moderna and they're eligible, or at their two-month mark if they got J&J. But getting it, you know, close to that as you can is not a bad idea.
So who should actually get a booster and when should they get it? Let's bring in Dr. Peter Hotez, co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital. He joins us on Skype. And Dr. Hotez, welcome back. And let's start with the basics. 99 million Americans will soon be eligible. Who are these boosters recommended for?
Well, you know, I think in the way to think of this, in the case of the mRNA vaccines, the Pfizer-BioNTech and the Moderna vaccine, it's a booster for selected populations that we'll talk about. For the J&J vaccine, it's not really a booster. It's sort of an autocorrection. And this, you know, probably always was a two-dose vaccine. It's not that protection is waning in the case of the J&J vaccine. It's just that it's better as a two-dose vaccine. So anyone who's gotten a dose of the J&J vaccine should get a second dose, and we can talk about maybe a few exceptions. And then for the case of the two mRNA vaccines, there's a list of recommendations for which group should get it.
Oh, that's interesting about Johnson & Johnson and it being kind of a correction to the one dose. You heard the Surgeon General say that people don't have to hurry out and do this. So who needs to actually get one quickly? And should those who got Johnson & Johnson for that first shot be more proactive than, say, Moderna recipients?
Yeah, the recommendation for the J&J, since it's protecting around the 70% level against symptomatic illness or possibly severe disease, you could bump it up to over 90% by getting that second dose. So that would be the recommendation. There's some discussion about the fact that some people did better if they got an mRNA booster instead of a second dose of J&J vaccine. But I thought those studies tended to stack the deck against seeing a favorable benefit of the J&J vaccine because the antibody response tends to get a little delayed. So I still think the J&J vaccine is a two-dose vaccine, is an excellent vaccine. The one group that might want to avoid the J&J and get the mRNA instead, if you're a young woman or a woman under the age of 40 or 50 and either on birth control or pregnant because you're more susceptible to thrombotic events, that's one of the rare complications of the J&J vaccine. Those individuals may want to get the mRNA instead of the second dose J&J, but there's going to be a lot more data on getting the same vaccine as the boost rather than the second dose rather than another one, a heterologous boost, as we call it.
I see. Now that boosters are available, can we expect to see a moment, say, when we'll need a booster to be considered fully vaccinated, a time when maybe we'll need a third shot to get into places like restaurants and gyms and movies or even our workplaces?
Potentially. I think it's important to point out that this doesn't necessarily mean we're going to need an annual booster. So I'm thinking for the mRNA vaccines, it's not going to be one and done or two and done, but three and done. And I think that may be it for a while because that third dose does seem to give a lot more robust level of immunity. And I think it's going to be a lot more durable. I think part of the problem was the messaging of the mRNA vaccines. It was always a three-dose vaccine that I've been saying since the beginning, because we gave those first two doses so close together. And that when we do that, for instance, with pediatric vaccines, we always need to give a boost later on, 6 months to a year later, and mRNA is going by that same playbook. So the hope is that once you get that third dose, and I think, yes, fully vaccinated will mean three doses for the mRNA eventually, then that may be it for a while.
Really quickly, I just have under a minute with you. Do we have any idea whether the booster will offer added protection against the most recent strain of the Delta variant?
It looks as though not only does it give stronger, more robust protection, but there's still some disagreement in the scientific community, but by having those much higher levels of virus neutralizing antibody and T cell responses, you do seem to seem to have some more resilience against the variants, like the Delta variant. So it's a good vaccine against Delta.
There's so much to watch for. Okay, 10 seconds. Side effects, 2-dose regimen, having a third one. Do we expect to see side effects?
So that's something that's going to have to be looked at really closely. So far in Israel, as far as I know, they've not seen an increase in myocarditis with the third dose of the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine, but that'll be something that we'll look at.
Dr. Peter Hotez, as always, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
We're a little more than a week away from the United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP26, in Glasgow, Scotland. One of the issues on the agenda will be methane, and that's a change from previous climate talks where it hasn't been discussed, even though methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So far, more than 30 countries have pledged to cut methane emissions, but some of the biggest emitters are not yet on board. Mark Brownstein is Senior Vice President of Energy Transition at the Environmental Defense Fund, and he joins us now. Mark, welcome.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I look forward to the conversation.
And we're glad to have you. So I think it's fair to say that until now, carbon dioxide emissions have gotten all the attention when it comes to climate change. Why has methane largely been overlooked?
Well, I think for many years, we were all focused on carbon dioxide and the role that it plays in warming over the long term. But I think more recently, science is coming around to the view that we need to control the rate of warming as well as the total amount of warming that we will experience. And methane is one of the primary drivers of the rate of warming, that is, how fast our planet heats up. In fact, a quarter of all the warming that we're experiencing right now is being generated by methane emissions from human activities. So it's a pretty big deal.
Can you explain that? I mean, because compared to carbon dioxide, my understanding is that methane doesn't last as long in the atmosphere. But what is the risk? How damaging is it?
Well, think of carbon dioxide as building this blanket over the Earth over time. And the more carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere, the thicker that blanket is getting. And once we put carbon dioxide up into the atmosphere, it stays there for, you know, millennia. Methane does not last in the atmosphere nearly as long as carbon dioxide, only a couple of decades. But for the time that it's in the atmosphere, it is far more effective at trapping the Earth's heat than carbon dioxide. So it really contributes to the rate at which the planet heats up. So what we've learned is that to have an effective strategy to deal with climate change, you really need to deal with both variables, you know, the amount of pollution that builds up in the atmosphere over time, and then these super pollutants that really drive the rate of warming.
When I think of methane, I think of cows and landfills. Where is the methane coming from, and in which of the sources is posing the biggest harm?
So we have three big sources of methane from human activity. Agriculture, which is largely about cows, beef and dairy, some rice farming. We have landfills, which is all the garbage that we throw away. And then we have fossil fuel production and use, and that's largely about oil and gas. And one of the things that we've learned is that the biggest opportunity to make the biggest reduction soonest is in the oil and gas sector.
How do we do that?
Well, you know, it comes down to finding and fixing leaks. It comes down to ending venting and flaring at oil and gas facilities. It's really some really practical, basic stuff, maintaining facilities better. And that's the reason why we look to the oil and gas industry as the biggest opportunity to fix things the soonest, because it's really basic stuff that contributes to fixing the problem.
It does seem like countries are starting to pay attention to this. The United States recently joined with more than 30 other countries to tackle methane emissions, and it comes ahead of the UN Climate Change Conference coming up next week. Do you think that countries around the world are starting to give this gas the attention that it deserves?
Yeah, well, I think this COP is all about what can we do. We know that we're not making enough reductions to solve the climate crisis. And so this COP is really about what are the next steps that countries and companies can take to make a big difference. Well, we know that we have to ramp up how quickly we move away from the use of fossil fuels. But what the science is telling us is that we also need to ramp up our efforts to reduce methane pollution and do that in parallel to everything that we're doing on decarbonization. And I think the world's policymakers, the world's leaders are beginning to understand this new science and beginning to act on it.
How much of a difference would it make if they were able to bring methane emissions down significantly?
I mean, this gets a little geeky, but you know, we talk about staying below a warming threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius. We could get, you know, probably 20% of the needed reductions to stay below that critical threshold just by finding and fixing leaks in the oil and gas industry.
Mark Brownstein is Senior Vice President of Energy Transition at the Environmental Defense Fund. Thank you very much.
Sure.
There are so many unanswered questions today after a terrible accident on the set of a Hollywood movie. Police say actor Alec Baldwin fired a prop gun on set in New Mexico yesterday. The director of photography, Helena Hutchins, died after that gun went off. The movie's director, Joel Souza, was also injured. He's in the hospital. Let's try to get some answers. Joining us now is John Horn, arts and entertainment host for member station KPCC in Pasadena, California. John, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
I know it's still early in this investigation. We don't have a lot of details, but what do we know?
Well, I guess what we do know is this sounds like something went horribly wrong in the prop department. I mean, that's what the investigators are suggesting already, that it was a prop gun that Alec Baldwin was using on the set. A couple things about the movie. It's a 19th century Western. It's called Rust. And oddly enough, its plot is about an accidental killing. Production has been suspended, and we'll see if the picture ever resumes production or is abandoned. And also, Baldwin has been questioned by investigators and released, and it sounds like no arrests or charges have been filed so far.
So there's a pretty fundamental question here, John, which is how in the world could this have happened?
That's the question. And if you know Hollywood history, you would think the town would have learned from past mistakes. So there are a couple previous incidents. In 1984, an actor named John Eric Hexum died of an accidental self-inflicted wound to the head. He fired a blank cartridge, thinking it wouldn't do anything, but just because it's a blank doesn't mean there isn't a projectile. He was 26 at the time of his death. And then about 10 years later, 1993, Brandon Lee, who is the son of the martial arts legend Bruce Lee, was killed when a gun that was supposed to have blanks in it instead had a live round. It's important to note that a Twitter account run by Lee's sister posted this yesterday. No one should ever be killed by a gun on a film set, period.
There's no doubt about that. So help us understand, you know, what these prop guns are. Are they actual guns? They just fire blanks?
It depends on the film. Again, these are some of the questions. Was it a period gun? This is a story set in the mid-19th century. So was this an 1850 era's gun? Who was responsible for checking the gun? Was it loaded with blanks? Why was Baldwin aiming the weapon at the cinematographer and the director, who was also injured, and not some other actor or in a scene? Because it's very rare that a director and a cinematographer would be next to each other during the filming of a scene. Typically, cinematographer might be behind camera. She might be, you know, at Video Village with the director, you know, many, many feet away. So why were they together? And there's also this bigger question. A lot of films now don't even use blanks. They use basically like airsoft guns that you would see. It's, you know, one of those airsoft parks. They make a popping sound and they add, you know, the sound of the gunfire through sound effects at the end of production. So why do they even need blanks? I mean, I think that's another question a lot of people were asked about, if indeed there were blanks in the gun.
We can only imagine what Alec Baldwin is going through today. He was seen outside the sheriff's office near Santa Fe where this happened. He was in tears. How do you think this will resonate through Hollywood?
Obviously, it's horrible when anybody dies in an accident like this. The cinematographer, Helena Hutchins, was not only really young, she was 42 years old, but she was a woman in a man's world. I mean, this is a job that men dominate. So she was extremely talented because you have to be better than your male peers to make it in this job, given Hollywood's systemic discrimination against women as cinematographers. She had a bright future ahead of her. Again, she was taken way too early.
John Horn is arts and entertainment host for member station KPCC in Pasadena, California. John, a terrible story. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
All right, let's take a moment now to talk about social media and the internet and how they have forever changed the way we relate to our memories. Earlier this week, I posted a picture on Twitter of a fence that I rebuilt with my dad, and it's likely that in a few years I'll see that picture again and remember the backyard project fondly. But the internet also has a way of reminding us of sad memories, of deaths that still haunt us, of miscarriages or failed relationships. Lauren Good knows exactly what I'm talking about. She's a senior writer with Wired. Her piece on this subject is headlined, "I Called Off My Wedding, The Internet Will Never Forget." Lauren, hi.
Thanks for having me on, Peter.
And wow, what a headline. What happened to you that gave you some very personal perspective on the long memory of the internet?
You gotta love it when an interview starts with, "What happened to you?" Yeah, so I did call off my wedding, and this was back in the spring of 2019. So this was pre-pandemic, and this was just good old-fashioned dysfunction and realizing that the relationship was absolutely not going to work. And it wasn't a short relationship. It was the greater part of a decade. And what I realized in the months and then eventually the years in the aftermath of calling off the wedding and ending the relationship was that I just kept seeing memories of both the event itself or the planned event, which didn't happen, the wedding, and the relationship, the years and years of the relationship, because what had happened was our relationship had sort of coincided with my career as a tech reporter. I had started covering tech and consumer tech specifically in the early 2010s, and I was always trying all these new applications and services. And so I was like just constantly online and living my life through applications while going through this relationship. And what I found was that my digital footprint was just enormous and that I was just being flooded with all of these memories, even as I was trying to move on.
Because you had, as all of us do, or many of us do, just so many pictures and memories to be reminded of.
I have gotten a few remarks from outliers who say, "Wow, lady, maybe you're on the internet a little too much. Maybe other people aren't spending this much time on the internet." But I think a lot of us are, and a lot of us are sharing photos and tweeting and posting to Facebook and doing things sometimes without even really thinking about it these days and leaving these you know, digital breadcrumbs, these trails of our lives.
Well, and speaking of breadcrumbs, I mean, one of the pictures that you were reminded of was an image of the breakfast that you ate and had posted a photo of the day that you decided to call off the wedding and the relationship. What was that like to see that picture?
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. I had made breakfast that morning and taken a photo of it, and it was very unremarkable. It was a fried egg. And then I didn't actually end up sharing it. What happened was later on, just as Apple Photos or Google Photos was kind of like resurfacing memories to me all the time, the egg photo popped up, and I was like, why do I have this photo in my camera roll? Oh, I took it that morning, and I never ate the breakfast because I was so just distraught. I never ate. It's an unremarkable photo, but it's got so much emotion packed into it. And it's reminding me of something I really just don't want to remember. I just want to move on. And then it just kept happening.
Clearly, these companies see digital memories as an opportunity to make money. But do you think they also understand that it's a potential source of friction with their customers? Do they even care about that?
And I think more recently with stories like mine and some other reporters who have called out some of the more painful elements of seeing these digital footprints, these digital breadcrumbs all the time, I think there are some changes we're starting to see in the software that makes it less likely you'll see things that are painful to you. And you also have some manual control over what you see too. As I wrote in the story, these features are supposedly personalized, is a word we hear a lot these days with regards to artificially intelligent applications. They still don't know you personally. And so the apps are not smart enough to know what you do want to see and what you don't want to see.
So if you wanted to be proactive and tell these companies to let your canceled wedding memories just be forgotten, Is that an option at this point?
I don't think that they are particularly strong features. At the time, I did some reporting on Pinterest because I was being shown a lot of wedding-related Pinterest pins even after long after I'd canceled the wedding. And Pinterest at the time said that they were aware of this problem and that they had introduced a feature that would let you, quote-unquote, tune your home feed, where you could sort of unfollow entire topics that you were no longer interested in or were no longer relevant to you, instead of having to go through and unpin things one by one. But still, it required a little bit of work and didn't really fix the problem for me. And then more recently, in some of the photo apps that people use, such as Google Photos and Apple Photos, we've seen updates that maybe let you select a person whose memories you want to change. You can do feature this person less or you know, don't feature this person at all in my memories. You can remove a single photo from a memory collage that they've put together if there's one errant photo in there you don't want to see. So there are these small tweaks, but they still require a lot of action on the part of the user.
Well, isn't that an important point? That if something traumatic happens to us, or there's something that we'd rather forget, like maybe that's not the solution. Maybe trying to never see a picture again of something that bothers us is not the best way to actually deal with it. And that's just part of life. It's being confronted by past memories.
That's right. And there might be some generational differences here. One of the people I spoke to for my article, Kate Eichhorn, is the author of a book called The End of Forgetting. And she writes a lot about how people from earlier generations, you know, may not have had that many photos, physical photos lying around. They certainly didn't have the number of digital photos that we now have. But they still would keep those photos, you know, in a box or in an album and go through them from time to time and point out certain things to younger family members. And, you know, this was your great-grandfather, or this was when he came back from the war, or whatever it was. Not all of those memories are great memories. Some of them may be painful, but they're an important part of maintaining legacy and also just, yeah, kind of confronting the past in a way. If you just obliterate every memory, every digital memory you've ever had because you want to avoid pain, I don't actually think that's the solution.
Lauren Good is a senior writer with Wired. We'll link you to her piece. That's headlined, "I Called Off My Wedding and the Internet Will Never Forget." Lauren, thanks for sharing your experience with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for your thoughtful questions, Peter. It was great to chat.
China has reportedly tested a powerful new kind of weapon, a long-range hypersonic missile. NPR's Jeff Brumfiel has more on what some fear is becoming a dangerous arms race.
In July, the China Academy of Launch Vehicle Technology announced the 77th launch of one of its rockets. In late August, it announced the 79th. The question is, what happened to launch number 78? According to a report in the Financial Times this past weekend, it was a secret test of a powerful new kind of hypersonic missile.
I think the simplest way to imagine this weapon system is to imagine the space shuttle, put a nuclear weapon in the cargo bay, and then don't bother with the landing gear.
Jeffrey Lewis is a professor at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. This hypersonic weapon launches briefly into orbit,
and it glides back to the Earth, just like the space shuttle, except for when it gets where it's going, it goes boom.
The new weapon would be significant because it could attack the U.S. from an unexpected direction, even, say, the South Pole. The Pentagon would not comment on the report, and a Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson said it was an experimental spacecraft, not a weapon. But China has been investing heavily in shorter-range hypersonic missiles. They skim through the upper atmosphere at more than five times the speed of sound and can also change direction during flight. Tong Zhao is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Beijing.
Given the capability for hypersonic missiles to maneuver during flight, and given their rather fast speed, they can better penetrate missile defense systems.
Zhao says that China sees U.S. missile defenses as a major threat. It's been building up its stockpile of shorter-range weapons. This long-distance one, if it was in fact tested, fits into that pattern. Zhao says in the big picture, Chinese leadership wants to protect itself from what it sees as growing U.S. aggression.
China feels it needs a greater overall military power, including a stronger nuclear power, to basically ensure the U.S. wouldn't be able to interfere in Chinese internal matters.
Not everyone agrees that China's buildup of hypersonic weapons is defensive. Michael Griffin is a former Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering. He says China's hypersonic arsenal allows it to expand its influence in the region.
One can target airfields and aircraft carriers within 15 or 20 minutes of flight time, literally thousands of kilometers away from the Chinese mainland.
That puts the U.S., which is trying to expand its military presence in the Western Pacific, at risk. Griffin says that the U.S. needs to develop and stockpile hypersonic missiles of its own to counter the Chinese threat. And if that sounds like an arms race, well...
I'm not one to mince words. It is an arms race. And critically, we didn't start it.
But Jeffrey Lewis says a race is supposed to have a finish line. This is more like the two sides are on treadmills.
The only victory is to be first off the treadmill. So what we need to do is find a way to exit the arms race rather than accelerate it.
One way, he believes, is for the U.S. to be more open to limits on missile defenses, which are driving the hypersonic craze. If the latest reports of this nuclear-capable long-range Chinese weapon are true, the race seems to be speeding up for now, and the Pentagon is doing what it can to keep pace. Today it announced it had tested parts of its own hypersonic design. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.
A federal rule designed to keep renters in their homes during the pandemic expired at the end of July, which means landlords finally had a way to legally evict tenants who hadn't paid rent in months. But evictions never really stopped, even while the ban was in place. Sarah Hasmer does housing policy work for the National Women's Law Center. She says some judges just ignored the order.
A lot of tenants don't have legal representation when they show up to eviction court, and eviction court is so fast-paced. Meanwhile, landlords often have that representation, and so there's just a real imbalance of power between landlords, judges, and tenants.
Hasmer introduced me to one of those tenants, a woman from Phoenix, Arizona, who was evicted just days before the ban expired.
This year is going to be for your mailbox, okay. Sure to fill that out.
Fill it out and put it in there.
Okay, yes. Cool.
I met Shantara Brown a week ago inside the sales office of an apartment complex in Northwest Phoenix. For Brown, it wasn't easy to get here. On July 26th, she was evicted from her apartment. And for the next 80 days, the single mother of three who worked in a warehouse moved her kids from Airbnbs to hotel rooms, trying to keep her family off the streets. The experience nearly unraveled her life. But on this day, in the middle of October, she finally got a break.
Now for the fun part.
Keys to a new place.
Thank you so much.
Of course. Welcome home.
Feel good to get those keys?
Yes. Oh my gosh, it's been a journey. When I say the stress and relief off my chest right now is crazy.
Brown leaves the rental office to go get her kids in the parking lot. She grabs a few bags from the trunk of her car and then leads them to the front door of their new apartment.
Unlocking that door. Here we go, kids.
Whoa, there's carpet and everything.
Yes, there's carpet, a walk-in closet, new appliances. It's modest, but it's home.
I'm feeling really excited because now we're settling in.
This is Malaya. She's 9 years old.
Like, we can go to school. And I'm really excited to make new friends and stuff.
Have the last few months been kind of hard?
Yeah.
Yes. Basically, the last year has been iffy.
That's Malaya's 16-year-old brother, Milan. Both kids, along with Milan's twin, Makai, have been remote learning since the pandemic started. And they're sick of it. They haven't been able to go to a classroom because the family's been moving around so much.
In and out of Airbnbs, apartments,
hotels.
It's just haven't been our year. But we just got to go through it. you know.
You got to go through it, and here you are right now. You got a new place to live. How are you feeling about that?
I'm feeling good. I can't wait to be in here, like, up in here, like, having my stuff in corners and stuff. Like, man, at least we got something. Like, at least we don't have to be in a room or, yeah, we got our own. So, I mean, I can't complain.
Though who would blame him if he did? Milan's year was upended with a diagnosis. His mom told me how it started.
Me and my kids tested positive for COVID. From then, it was like basically an ongoing struggle for me to keep up with the bills because I actually was sick for, out of work for like 20 plus days.
Not getting paid?
Towards the end, no, because I had to use like my vacation pay and stuff like that. January to March, I was basically struggling to pay and get my rent paid, and they took me to court. I found out on July 20th that I had until July 26th to get out.
That moratorium didn't expire till the end of July.
Yes, I actually begged the judge to give me until the end of it, but he still signed the writ to get me out of there. And they threw it on my credit like almost immediately. So like I went to a rental agency and they pulled it straight up like, oh no, we can't rent to you because of this.
Because you had an eviction on your record. You yes. could no longer rent an apartment.
No.
Which basically meant what? That you were homeless.
Homeless. So yeah.
So if your house was sort of built with dominoes or something, COVID might have been the thing that...
That, boop! Yeah, it was building and it just tumbled once COVID came. It was one of the elements that just sent me into a spiral of debt.
What was it like to live at the hotels?
It was crazy because I could have got cheaper places, but three kids would be there by themselves all day. Me working 10-hour shifts, 60 hours a week, I need to have them in a place that is safe. I used to have to tell all my supervisors at work, hey, I know we ain't supposed to have phones on the floor, but y'all already know I need my phone because my nerves gonna be bad because of my kids.
You have no idea what your kids are up to, yes. living in this hotel, trying to go to school remotely.
Right. I'm basically asking them to be adults because when kids are in school, they have an adult teaching them. So them being homeschooled in a hotel with me at work, come on.
What was that worry like? What were you concerned about?
I was concerned about their safety. I was concerned about their grades because my daughter is a straight A student until distant learning. You know, it's not a good thing. I understand that I had a whole lot on their back, asking them to be very, very mature.
By now, you may be asking yourself, if Shantara Brown is so deep in debt, how did she get back on her feet? Well, the answer is she had help. After the eviction, she paid for the hotel rooms with a GoFundMe campaign. But to get into this new apartment, she needed more than that. She needed the government to pay her previous landlord the $4,800 she still owed in back rent. Getting that money to clear her record was no easy task.
Congress passed $46.5 billion in emergency rental assistance, but unfortunately, states and localities didn't have the infrastructure to really get these funds out to tenants and landlords who need it quickly.
That's Sarah Hasmer again, the housing advocate who helped Brown navigate the system in Phoenix all the way from her home office in Maryland.
Even before she got the eviction, she was making dozens of phone calls to the city of Phoenix trying to get relief. I even tried, but most of the time I couldn't get through either.
Hasmer says she and Brown waited and waited and waited for nearly 3 months to get the money for the back rent.
It was just a very frustrating process.
In fact, many cities across the country were unprepared for the demand when Congress left it up to local governments to distribute the money. A spokesperson for the city of Phoenix told me it's helped nearly 5,500 families and paid out about $42 million in rental relief. That's 90% of the federal money the city's gotten since March.
Son.
Yes.
Son. I'm excited. I'm sorry.
And it may have taken a while, but Shantara Brown finally got her check, which means her back rent has been paid and the kids are out of the hotel.
We need everything. We're gonna
We need pots,
we
pans.
We got that. Remember, I had just bought a pot set.
It's in storage.
Son.
Yes.
It's okay.
Okay.
Go ahead and help your brother.
In this new, empty apartment, still full of potential, you can almost feel the relief.
I can't wait to get a bed in this place so I can finally just... because, yes, I don't know how I did it. I just can say that it's a whole lot of inconsiderate people in this world when it comes to people that struggle. Everybody think it's that person's fault that they're struggling when they don't understand I'm only one person and I don't get no other assistance for my kids. If I don't make it, they don't have it, period.
So you must be proud of yourself then and your family.
I'm proud, but I'm just sad. I tell my kids all the time, I apologize because I felt like I should have been more established. I know I can't do nothing about it, but I want them to be established so they won't have to go through what I'm going through right now. Yep.
I can tell you're a good mom.
I try.
Truth is, Shantara Brown still can't rest. The rent on her new apartment is $1,500 a month. She's looking for a new job, and the bills keep coming. We'll keep an eye on her and her story in the months ahead.
You may remember La Niña. That's where the surface of the Pacific Ocean cools off. Well, the phenomenon is back, and while it may sound like a good thing because climate change is often warming oceans, scientists say the current La Niña could intensify drought conditions in the West and prolong next year's fire season. To help us understand why, we're joined by Park Williams, a bioclimatologist at UCLA. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks very much.
First, help us understand in the simplest terms what La Niña is and how often it occurs.
Sure. Like you said, La Niña is essentially the opposite of El Niño. La Niña is when the sea surface temperatures in the tropical Pacific Ocean are abnormally cool, especially off the coast of South America and the Galapagos out through the central Pacific. On the other side of the ocean, near Indonesia, the maritime continent, sea surface temperatures tend to be abnormally warm during La Niña periods. And while it seems like this shouldn't affect us very much, a reorganization of what parts of the tropical Pacific are cold versus warm totally reorganizes the way that the atmosphere circulates. And La Niña events tend to cause drought conditions in the southwestern United States.
We've been hearing this called a double dip phenomenon. Have you heard of this before, and what does that mean in the long term when we see La Niña events happen year after year?
Yeah, you know, the term double dip is something that was actually new to me, but the concept isn't. It isn't all that infrequent, actually, to get two La Niña years in a row or a cluster of La Niña events. The early 2000s, for example, 2000 through 2003, all or most of those years were La Niña years. 2020 was kind of a mild La Niña, but because of bad luck, 2020 and 2021 were quite dry across the Western United States. 2021 was extremely dry. Now, in 2022, we have a forecast for a stronger La Niña event. Now, that doesn't guarantee that 2022 is going to be dry across the entire Western United States and northern Mexico, but it loads the dice for drier conditions, which across a lot of the region, which is already extremely drought-stressed, does not come as very good news.
How is the ebb and flow of La Niña and El Niño impacted by climate change? Can we expect it to become more volatile as the planet continues warming up?
Well, there's a huge amount of debate about what is going to happen to El Niño and La Niña in a warmer world. There's evidence left behind by clues stored for us by the Earth itself that indicate that during prior globally warm events, then the Pacific Ocean has actually been in a more El Niño-like state, which could end up being meaning more often extreme wet conditions in the Southwest. But when we look to see what has happened over the last century, we don't see a trend toward a more La Nina-like climate or in a more El Nino-like climate, but we have seen a trend toward more variability, meaning the El Ninos have been stronger and the La Ninas have been stronger. There's a huge amount of debate whether or not that trend is due to human-caused global warming itself or is just part of the Earth's natural range of variability.
You study this. What are some of the things that you are watching out for as you study this year and moving forward?
Well, one thing that I'm really interested in and concerned with is the rapid increase that we've seen in wildfire activity in Western North America. When we look from year to year, we see that the big swings from year to year in the amount of area burned, especially in forests, corresponds surprisingly well with the dryness of the environment. Over the last 40 years, we've seen a big trend toward drier conditions. And some of that is probably due to regular old bad luck. A lot of the years in the 2000s have been due to or have coincided with La Nina conditions. But some of it is very likely because of warmer temperatures that are caused by global warming itself. A warmer atmosphere dries out ecosystems and vegetation. Now, this year, this coming year coming up, could have very well been a big El Nino year, which could have meant a temporary break in what has been a sequence of really bad wildfire years. 2019 was a nice break after really bad years in 2017, 2018. 2020 and 2021 were off the charts compared to what we've seen in other years over the last century in the Western United States. And with a La Nina now forecast for 2022, the dice are loaded for a third straight year of very extensive wildfire conditions. Now, I want to add that wildfire isn't inherently a totally bad thing, but we're living in places that are flammable, and those places are burning increasingly frequently.
Park Williams is a bioclimatologist and associate professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, talking with us about La Nina. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in beautiful Boston. It's Here and Now.